Good evening. My name is Agnes Gund, and I'm very, very honored to be able to introduce our speaker for this evening's program. Before we begin, I would like to mention that tonight's talk will be sign language interpreted, so we have reserved a few seats at the front of the theater for anyone who will benefit from an interpreter. Any of our staff, Sheetal is standing right there, would be happy to help you find these reserved seats. This evening, Dr. Oliver Sacks will read from his 1998 publication, The Island of the Colorblind, and take questions afterwards. Oliver is a wonder of a person, a great writer and researcher, and a very generous solver of problems for people that need someone who cares. In less flowery language, I'll read his biography. He's a physician, a best-selling author, and a professor of neurology and psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center. And he is the author of 10 books, including his most recent, The Mind's Eye, and holds the unique title of the Columbia University Artist in recognition of his contributions to the arts. And I know people that I was having dinner with this last weekend that have heard him speak up there and say it's fascinating to hear him. So I'm especially looking forward to tonight. Dr. Sacks received his medical degree from Oxford University and has lived and worked in New York City since 1965. In 1966, he began working as a consultant at Beth Abraham, a chronic care hospital in the Bronx. Here he found a group of patients, survivors of a forgotten encephalitis epidemic, who had been frozen nearly motionless for decades. Using the experimental drug L-DOPA, he brought them back to a conscious and functional state. He wrote about his experience in his book Awakenings, which later inspired a play by Harold Pinter, and subsequently an Oscar-nominated film with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro. Dr. Sacks is best known for carefully documenting case histories of patients living with a variety of neurological conditions, including Parkinson's, epilepsy, and dementia. Sacks' work, which has been supported by the Guggenheim Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, regularly appears in The New Yorker and the New York Review of Books, as well as various medical journals. Israel Rosenfield, writing in the New York Times, has referred to him as the poet laureate of medicine. And that's where he's more than that because he's so generous with what he discovers and passes on. In the 1990s, Dr. Sacks spent time investigating a rare community of colorblind people as he documented in his book, The Island of the Colorblind. Drawn to the tiny Pacific atoll of Pingalap, by intriguing reports of an isolated community of islanders born totally colorblind, Dr. Sacks found himself setting up a clinic in a one-room island dispensary where he listened to these achromatopic people describe their colorless world in rich terms of pattern, tone, luminescence, and shadow. On Guam, where he went to investigate the puzzling neurodegenerative paralysis endemic there for a century, he became, for a brief time, an island neurologist, making house calls with his colleague, John Steele, amid crowing cockerels, cicada jungles, and the remains of a colonial culture. Tonight's reading from The Island of the Colorblind is organized in conjunction with the publication of The Island of Rhoda, a limited edition book published by the Library Council of the Museum of Modern Art to benefit MoMA's Library and Art Museum Archives. The Island of Rhoda unites a chapter of Sacks, The Island of the Colorblind, that is focused on the ancient ferns and cycads found on a geographically isolated Micronesian island with original photographs by Abelardo Morel and designed by Ted Muehling. It's an absolutely stunning book, and I hope anybody that's interested will talk with Mylon Houston, who is the head of our library, following this program. Following tonight's program, Dr. Sacks will be signing books outside the theater. The Island of the Colorblind will be available for purchase along with his most recent book, The Mind's Eye. And that's a fascinating book that I've have the privilege to give to a lot of friends, and they really like it and find it fascinating. I have a brother that's blind, and the modern works with people in their programs for the hearing impaired and the sight impaired here at the museum, so I'm especially interested in the discussion of that. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Oliver Sacks. Oops, I have to take this.
Thank you very much, Aggie, for that beautiful introduction, and I thank all the rest of you for coming here despite the threat of an apocalyptic snowstorm. Well, I'm delighted to be here, and the very special edition of the Island of Rota will be on display outside, and you can see it. Each page has demanded dozens or hundreds of man hours, and it is really an exquisite work in its own right, especially with the gorgeous photographs and of Abe Morell and the design by Ted Muling. And I think the idea for such a book was originally conceived by you, Aggie, and then May Castleberry sort of held everything together in the very complex production. The book itself, as The Island of the Colorblind, is really two books. In its English edition, it's called The Island of the Colorblind and Cycad Island. It's an odd mixture of travel narrative and neurology and botany and fantasy in about equal amounts. The Island of Rota is the botanical part and comes at the end of the book. But I'm first going to read something about the Island of the Colorblind. I've always been interested in the perception of color and, in the opposite of this, the inability of some people to perceive certain colors or very rarely to perceive any color whatever. And the term achromatopsia is used of people who have never experienced color and, in a sense, can have no idea of what it's like. This is a pretty rare condition in the general population, about 1 in 30 or 40,000. But I found there was a little island, a coral atoll in Micronesia, where something like a seventh of the population had achromatopsia. And this had been endemic on the island since the beginning of the 19th century, and there was, in fact, as I was to find, an entire achromatopic culture on the island with their own values, their own art, and everything else. So I'm going to read you some from our arrival on Pingalap, and also the last evening there. I went to Pingalap with a friend and colleague who was himself achromatopic, as was his brother and his sister, but who was very, very curious to meet a whole population of people like himself. And an ophthalmologist friend of mine, Knut and Bob. It was a long, complicated journey down to the atoll, and the final hop was made in a little plane designed for short runways. The plane was slow, but had a reassuring, steady drone, and we flew low enough to see shoals of tuna in the water. It took about 4 hours to get to Pingelap, which were three islets forming a broken crescent around the lagoon. We flew twice around the atoll to get a closer view, a view which at first disclosed nothing but unbroken forest. It was only when we skimmed the trees 200 feet from the ground that we could make out paths intersecting the forest here and there, and low houses almost hidden in the foliage. Very suddenly, the wind rose. It had been tranquil a few minutes before, and the coconut palms and pandanus trees began lashing to and fro. As we made for the tiny concrete airstrip at one end, built by the occupying Japanese a half century before, a violent tailwind seized us near the ground and almost blew us off the side of the runway. Our pilot struggled to control the skidding plane, for now, having just missed the edge of the landing strip, we were in danger of shooting off the end. By main force and luck, he just managed to bring the plane around another 6 inches, and we would have been in the lagoon. "You folks okay?" he asked us, and then to himself, "Worst landing I ever had." Knut and Bob were ashen, the pilot too. They had visions of being submerged in the plane, struggling, suffocating, unable to get out. But even in our extremity, as the brakes screamed to halt us, I seemed to hear laughter, sounds of mirth all around us. As we got out, still pale with shock, dozens of lithe brown children ran out of the forest, waving flowers, banana leaves, laughing, surrounding us. I could see no adults at first, and thought for a moment that Pingelap was an island of children. "Beautiful," whispered Knut, enraptured by my side, and then, "Look at that child, and that one, and that." I followed his glance, and now suddenly saw what I had first missed. Here and there among the rest, clusters of children who squinted, screwed up their eyes against the bright sun, and one, an older boy, with a black cloth over his head. Knut had seen them, identified them, his achromatopic brethren, the moment he stepped out of the plane, as they clearly spotted him the moment he stepped out, squinting, dark-glassed, by the side of the plane. Though Knut had read the scientific literature and had occasionally met other achromatopic people, this had in no way prepared him for the impact of actually finding himself surrounded by his own kind, strangers half a world away with whom he had an instant kinship. It was an odd sort of encounter which the rest of us were witnessing. Pale Nordic Knut in his Western clothes, cam around his neck, and the small brown achromatopic children of Pingelap. Our arrival, with sleeping bags, bottled water, medical and film equipment, was an event almost without precedent. The island children were fascinated, not so much by our cameras as by the sound boom with its woolly muff, and within a day were making their own booms out of banana stalks and coconut wool. There was a lovely festive quality to this spontaneous procession, which had no order, no program, no leader, no precedence, just a raggle-taggle of wandering, gaping people, they at us, we at them, and everything around us, making our way with many stops and diversions and detours through the forest village of Pingelap. Little black and white piglets, darted across our path, unshy but unaffectionate, unpet-like too, leading their own seemingly autonomous existence, as if the island were equally theirs. We were struck by the fact that the pigs were black and white, and wondered half seriously if they had been specially bred for or by an achromatopic population. Knut was fascinated not only by the pigs, but by the richness of the vegetation, which he saw quite clearly, perhaps more clearly than the rest of us. For us, as colour normals, it was at first just a confusion of greens, whereas to Knut, it was a polyphony of brightnesses, tonalities, shapes, and textures, easily identified and distinguished from each other. He mentioned this to James, who was one of the islanders, a young achromatopic man, James, who said it was the same for him, for all the achromatopes of the island. None of them had any difficulty distinguishing the plants on the island. But what about bananas, let's say? Bob asked. Can you distinguish the yellow from the green ones? Not always, James replies. Pale green may look the same to me as yellow. How can you tell when a banana is ripe, then? James's answer was to go to a banana tree and to come back with a carefully selected bright green banana for Bob. Bob peeled it. It peeled easily, to his surprise. He took a small bite of it gingerly, then devoured the rest. You see, said James, we don't just go by colour. We look, we feel, we smell, we know. We take everything into consideration, and you just take colour. There's something I won't read about, but I will mention briefly, is some of the objects and art made by the achromatopes. There were very striking mats and hangings. If one looked at the mats, they at first seemed to be just a chaos of different colours, and one could see no form or anything else. And it was only as the light faded and dusk came and we lost our own colour vision that the mats came alive, because they were done entirely in terms of luminosity, and one cannot judge luminosity if one has colour vision, whereas an achromatopic person can judge it perfectly. And so this is the sort of special art of the achromatope, and perhaps one day it should be in a gallery, in a twilight gallery in New York. I'm going to jump to the end. On our last evening in Pingelap, a huge crimson sunset, shot with purples and yellows and a touch of green, hung over the ocean and filled half the sky. Even Knut exclaimed, "Unbelievable," and said he had never seen such a sunset before. As we came down to the shore, we saw dozens of people almost submerged in the water. Only their heads were visible above the reef. This happened every evening, James had told us. It was the only way to cool off. Looking round, we saw others lying, sitting, standing, and chatting in small clusters. It looked as if most of the island's population was here. The cooling hour, the social hour, the hour of immersion had begun. As it got darker, Knut and the achromatopic islanders moved more easily. It is common knowledge among the Pingelapese that those with the maskoon, that's their name for this condition, those with the maskoon manage better at scotopic times, dusk and dawn, and moonlit nights. And for this reason, they are often employed as night fishers. And in this, the achromatopes are preeminent. They seem able to see the fish in their dim course underwater, the glint of moonlight on their outstretched fins as they leap, as well as, or perhaps better, than anyone else. The waters of the Pacific are full of a tiny protozoan, Noctiluca, a bioluminescent creature able to generate light like a firefly. It was Knut who first noticed their phosphorescence in the water, a phosphorescence most evident when the water was disturbed. Sometimes, when the flying fish leapt out of the water, they would leave a luminous disturbance, a glowing wake as they did so, and another splash of light as they landed. Night fishing used to be done with a flaming torch. Now it is done with the help of a flashlight, the light serving to dazzle as well as spot the fish. As the beautiful creatures were illuminated in a blinding flashlight beam, I was reminded how, as a child, I would see German planes transfixed by roving searchlights as they flew in the darkened skies over London. One by one, we pursued the fish. We followed their careerings relentlessly, this way and that, until we could draw close enough for the fisher to shoot out the great hoop of his net and catch them as they returned to the water. They accumulated in the bottom of the boat, silvery, squirming, until they were hit on the head, although one actually, in its frenzy, managed to leap out of the boat, and we so admired this that we did not try to catch it again. After an hour, we had had enough, and it was time to go after deeper water fish. There were two teenage boys with us, one achromatopic. They now donned scuba gear and masks, and clutching spears and flashlights, went over the side of the boat. We could see them 200 yards or more from the boat, like luminous fish, the phosphorescent waters outlining their bodies as they moved. After 10 minutes, they returned, loaded with the fish they had speared, and climbed back into the boat, their wet scuba gear gleaming blackly in the moonlight. The long, slow trip back was very peaceful. We lay back in the boat. The fishers murmured softly among themselves. We had enough, more than enough, fish for all. Fires would be lit on the long, sandy beach, and we would have a grand final feast on Pingalap before flying back to Pompeii the next morning. We reached the shore and waded onto the beach, pulling the boat up behind us. The sand itself, broader with the tide's retreat, was still wet with the phosphorescent sea. And now, as we walked upon it, our footsteps left a luminous spoor. I'm sorry just to give you the beginning and end of something, but the meat, the middle, awaits you if you read the book. This is not what you think it is. And people are very suspicious when it's in a brown paper bag. But it's the only thing which would fit on this sloping podium. So half the book then is about the Caroline Islands, of Pompeii and atolls, and the achromatopsia there. And a lot of other things. There used to be a huge, a megalithic population, and there are enormous ruins which are now beneath the water in Pompeii. And you may have seen Roman and Greek and Egyptian ruins, but you have to see the Micronesian ruins to realize that there were equivalent cultures in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the Pacific. The other half of the book is divided between a consideration of Guam and an adjoining island, Rota. This adventure was started in 1991 by a colleague who phoned me from Guam and told me about a strange degenerative disease which affected the native Chamorro population and, in fact, at one point accounted for the majority of their deaths. I'd actually heard of this strange disease 30 years earlier when I was a resident in neurology, and I had no idea it still existed. But as Aggie said, my time in Guam was largely making house calls with a colleague. But then I was intrigued by a small island called Rota. Am I speaking too softly? Okay. A small island called Rota, a short flight from Guam. I was surprised some years ago when a man in my building had a Rota t-shirt. And I said, "You've been to Rota too?" And he said, "Sure." But as we talked, it was clear that we weren't talking about the same place. There is a village in Spain, or a small town in Spain, called Rota. And there's also a volcano in Panama. But this is the island of Rota, and there's only one of them. It starts with some reminiscence. When I was 5, our garden in London was full of ferns, a great jungle of them rising high above my head. My mother and a favorite sister adored gardening and were botanically inclined, and some of my earliest memories are of seeing them working side by side in the garden, often pausing to look at the young fronds, the baby fiddleheads, with great tenderness and delight. The memory of these ferns and of a quiet, idyllic botanizing became associated for me with the sense of childhood, of innocence, of a time before the war. By the way, I'll interrupt myself. Many families in England were ordered to pull up frivolous things like flowers and ferns and to replace them with crops, potatoes, carrots, whatever, or Jerusalem artichokes. In our case, the ferns had to make way for Jerusalem artichokes. I don't know whether any of you have much acquaintance with Jerusalem artichokes, but they contain a carbohydrate, a polysaccharide, which is completely indigestible. And so it goes straight through you. And an efficient, though disgusting, way of dieting would be to live on Jerusalem artichokes. There are zero assimilable calories. And it was really a great, strange mistake for the government to suggest that hungry England should grow these useless objects. Anyhow, I sort of... During the war years, my aunt was headmistress of a school in Cheshire, a fresh air school, as it was called, in the depths of Delamere Forest. It was she who first showed me living horsetails in the woods, growing a foot or two high in the wet ground by the sides of streams. She had me feel their stiff, jointed stems and told me that they were among the most ancient of living plants, and that their ancestors had grown to gigantic size, forming dense thickets of huge bamboo-like trees, twice as tall as the trees which now surrounded us. They had once covered the earth hundreds of millions of years ago, when giant amphibians ploshed through the primordial swamps. She would show me how the horsetails were anchored by a network of roots, the plant rhizomes, which sent out runners to each stalk. Then she would find tiny lycopods to show me, club mosses or tassel ferns, with their scaly leaves. These two, she told me, once took the form of immensely tall trees, more than 100 feet high, with huge scaly trunks supporting tasseled foliage and cones at their summits. At night, I dreamed of these silent, towering giant horsetails and club mosses the peaceful, swampy landscapes of 350 million years ago, a Paleozoic Eden, and I would wake with a sense of exhilaration and loss. My aunt often took me to the Natural History Museum in London, where there was a fossil garden full of ancient lycopod trees, their trunks covered with rugged rhomboid scales like crocodiles, and the slender trunks of tree horsetails, Calamites. Inside the museum, she would take me to see the dioramas of the Paleozoic. They had titles like Life in a Devonian Swamp. I love these even more than the pictures in books, and they became my new dreamscapes. Then we would move ahead 100 million years to the dioramas of the Jurassic, the Age of Cycads. And she would show me these great, robust trees, so different from the Paleozoic ones. The cycads had huge cones and massive fronds at their tops. They were the dominant plant form once, she would say. Pterodactyls flew among them. They were what the giant dinosaurs munched on. Although I had never seen a living cycad, these great trees with their thick, solid trunks seemed more believable, less alien than the unimaginable Calamites which preceded them. They looked like a cross between ferns and palms. I think at this point, it shouldn't be just words. I'm wearing a cycad. And this is the official cap of the Cycad Society. I have other T-shirts with ferns on them, and because I belong to the American Fern Society, the New York Fern Society, I wanted to have cycads on my front and ferns on my back, but this wasn't quite possible. Cycads. So this is what we're going to be talking about now. On summer Sundays, we would take the old district line to Kew Gardens. It cost a penny to enter, and for this one had the whole sweep of the gardens, its broad walks, its dells, the 18th century pagoda, and my favorites, the great glass and iron conservatories. And it was at Kew that I finally saw living cycads, clustered as they had been for a century or more in a corner of the great palm house. They too were survivors from a long distant past, and the stamp of their ancientness was manifest in every part of them, in their huge cones, their sharp spiny leaves, their heavy columnar trunks, reinforced like medieval armor by persistent leaf bases. If the tree ferns had grace, these cycads had grandeur, and to my boyish mind, a sort of moral dimension too. But there's an infinite difference between a garden, however grand, and the wild. And I yearn to see cycads in their own context, not planted, not labeled, not isolated for viewing, but growing side by side with banyans and screw pines and ferns all about them, the whole harmony and complexity of a full-scale cycad jungle, the living reality of my childhood dreamscape. Rota is Guam's closest companion in the Marianas chain and is geologically similar, with a complex history of risings and fallings, reef makings and destructions going back 40 million years or so. The two islands are inhabited by similar vegetation and animals, but Rota, lacking Guam's size, its grand harbors, its commercial and agricultural potential, has been far less modernized. Rota has been largely left to itself, biologically and culturally, and it can perhaps give one some idea of how Guam looked in the 16th century when it was still covered by dense forests of cycads. And this is why I wanted to come here. I would be meeting one of the island's few remaining medicine women, Beata Mendiola, and her son Tommy. They met me at the landing strip. Tommy is an engaging, intelligent man, fluent in Chamorro and English. Beata, lean, dark, with an aura of power, was born during the Japanese occupation and speaks Chamorro and Japanese only, so Tommy had to interpret it for us. We drove a few miles down a dirt road to the edge of the jungle and then went on by foot, Tommy and his mother with machetes leading the way. The jungle was so dense in places that light could hardly filter through, and I had the sense at times of a fairy wood, with every tree trunk, every branch wreathed in epiphytic mosses and ferns. I had only seen isolated cycads on Guam, perhaps two or three close together, but here there were hundreds dominating the jungle. They grew everywhere, some in clumps, some as isolated trunks, here and there reaching here and there 12 or 15 feet in height. Most, though, were relatively low, 5 or 6 feet tall, and surrounded by a thick carpet of ferns, thickened and strengthened with the scars of old leaves, leaf scales. These trunks looked mighty as locomotives or stegosaurs. High winds and typhoons beat through these islands regularly, and the trunks of them, of some of them, were bent at all angles, sometimes prostrate on the ground. But this, if anything, seemed to increase their vitality, for where they were bent, especially at the base, new growths, bulbils, had erupted in scores, bearing their own crowns of young leaves, still pale green and soft. While most of the cycads around us were tall, unbranched ones, whose life force seemed to be pouring upwards to the sky, there were others almost monstrous, which seemed to be running riot, exploding in all directions, full of anarchic vitality, sheer vegetable exuberance, hubris. A cycad forest is not lofty, like a pine or oak forest, but the trees give an impression of immense solidity and strength. They are heavy-duty models, one feels, not tall, not flashy, not capable of rapid growth like modern trees, but built to last, to withstand a typhoon or a drought. Heavy, armored, slow-growing, gigantic, they seem to bear like dinosaurs, the imprint of the Mesozoic, the style of 200 million years ago. The beauty of the forest is extraordinary, but beauty is too simple a word, for being here is not just an aesthetic experience, but one steeped in mystery and awe. The primeval, the sublime, are much better words here, for they indicate realms remote from the moral or the human, realms which force us to gaze into immense vistas of space and time. Now, as I wandered in the cycad forest on Rota, it seemed as if my senses were actually enlarging, as if a new sense, a time sense, was opening within me, something which might allow me to appreciate millennia or eons as directly as I had experienced seconds or minutes. I live on an island, City Island in New York. I don't anymore, but I did when I wrote the book. Surrounded by the brilliant, transient artifacts of man. And yet each June, without fail, horseshoe crabs come up from the sea, crawl on the beach, mate, deposit eggs, and then slowly swim away again. I love to swim in the bay alongside them. They permit this indifferently. They have crawled up to the shores and mated every summer as their ancestors have done since the Silurian 400 million years ago. Like the cycads, the horseshoe crabs are rugged models, great survivors which have endured. The sense of deep time brings a deep peace with it, a detachment from the time scale, the urgencies of daily life. Seeing these volcanic islands and coral atolls and wandering above all through the cycad forest on Rota has given me an intimate feeling of the antiquity of the earth and the slow, continuous processes by which different forms of life evolve and come into being. Standing here in the jungle, I feel part of a larger karma identity. I feel a profound sense of being at home, a sort of companionship with the earth. It is evening now, and as Tommy and Beata go off to gather some medicinal plants, I sit on the beach, looking out to sea. Cycads come down almost to the water's edge, and the strand is littered with their gigantic seeds, along with the tough egg cases of sharks and rays, which are shaped like bizarre fortune cookies. A light wind has sprung up, rustling the leaves of the cycads, blowing up little ripples on the water. Ghost crabs and fiddler crabs, hidden in the heat of the day, have emerged and are darting to and fro. The chief sound is the lapping of waves on the shore, lapping as they have done for billions of years, ever since land rose out of water, an ancient, soothing, hypnotic sound. I look at the cycad seeds curiously, thinking of Beata's words that they float and can perhaps survive long immersion in seawater. Most, no doubt, have dropped from the trees above me, but some perhaps are nomads brought here across the sea from Guam or more distant islands, perhaps even Yap or Palau or beyond. A large wave comes in, lifts a couple of the seeds, and they float, bobbing by the shore. 5 minutes later, one of the seeds has been cast up again on the shore, but the other is still bobbing atop the waves, a few feet from land. I wonder where it will go, or whether it will survive, will be cast back here on Rota, or taken hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles, to another island in the Pacific. 10 minutes more, and I can no longer see it. It has launched like a little ship on its journey on the high seas. Okay, thank you very much. I've never read such heterogeneous stuff, but I'd be delighted at any questions or comments you have.
Are you familiar with John Muir?
Yeah, I was in Muir Woods just a couple of weeks ago, and why do you ask?
Because he was known to catalog all these vegetation all throughout the United States and maybe even into Mexico.
I don't know whether John Muir ever got to these Pacific islands.
But it's the same, similar ferns, aren't they? Hi.
Similar current.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Oh, similar fern. Similar ferns.
Similar ferns. Okay. Well. Yeah. There's some overlaps. And incidentally, there's also been a human migration from Micronesia to California, and it now has a large Chamorro population as well, perhaps as some ferns from far away. But I'm no expert in this.
Thank you.
Did I miss it, or can you tell me what caused the disease, what causes the color blindness and the other a condition you spoke about?
What Kant mentioned.
Okay. In this congenital form of color blindness, the retina is normal at birth, but within a few weeks loses all of its cones, which are the color receptors, leaving only the rods. The rods are very sensitive to light, and people who have this are sort of almost blinded by daylight and have to wear heavy, dark glasses. Interestingly, an identical condition has been found in dogs, and near Philadelphia there is a colony of dogs also wearing dark glasses. The actual genetic and molecular processes responsible for this achromatopsia, the Pingelap disease, have in fact been identified in dogs. And so the treatment is now, so now perhaps the color blindness is potentially preventable. Although this raises complex cultural and ethical problems in a population. Why are there so many on Pingelap? In the 1780s, there was a typhoon which almost depopulated Pingelap. It has something like 1,000 people, and there were half a dozen survivors, all of royal blood and all closely related. They repopulated the island enthusiastically by themselves. And with this, a gene for achromatopsia, which happened to have been there, got concentrated, and this is why you have this concentrate or isolate there. This sort of thing can happen, happens on other islands or isolated mountain valleys. There may be particular plants or animals or diseases or other conditions. There was a little island off Denmark called Fur, F-U-R, which had a population of achromatopes, but that is no longer there. There's said to be a valley in Hawaii, a valley of absolute pitch, but maybe someone was pulling my leg. But anyhow, that's a little bit about this. Incidentally, the people with achromatopsia now have a network of their own, and it can be very lonely to have a strange condition which no one else in the town has and no one knows anything about. But now, one of the advantages of the web is that one can have contact with people in similar situations all over the world and share experiences, strategies, perspectives, and courage.
I had a question about some of your other writing. You have all these wonderful profiles in some of your books.
Yes.
And they follow characters over the course of different timescales. So some of them are, you'd follow someone and write about them over the course of 5 years. And some are shorter, and I was just wondering how you know when to write the story or if you continuously have patience that you're sort of thinking about writing in the future and when you know when it's time to write the story.
I regard being a physician as primary, and at first when I see anyone, I am more concerned with their welfare than the interest of or the drama of their cases. Usually quite a time goes past. For example, in my new book, I speak of a pianist, Lillian Kalia, who developed an odd problem and became unable to read music and then to read other things. She wrote to me in 99, and I saw her over a period of some years before it even occurred to me to write about her. When I did write about her, I sent the manuscript to her and to her husband and daughter, because I think one has to be entirely open about this sort of thing. I will say that formal consent is not enough for me. I have to be internally sure that the person is comfortable with being written about and being identified or not identified. There is one patient I'm seeing at the moment, and I think she will be the centerpiece of a coming book. Incidentally, I'm afraid I said nothing to the previous question about the disease on Guam, but I can either say it now or let it go.
Right. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Sorry. Okay. Well, the disease on Guam takes different forms. And at first it was thought that there were two or three strange diseases until all sorts of intermediate forms were found. There is a terrifying disease called ALS or motor neuron disease or Lou Gehrig disease, which is pretty rare in this country, again, something like 1 in 50,000. When Navy surgeons got to Guam in 1945, they found that this disease was 1,000 times commoner on Guam than elsewhere in the world. It was also found that there was a form of Parkinsonism, which was much commoner, and a form of dementia. The disease was not contagious, although there were some villages which were especially affected. With one village I went to, in fact, it was the village which Magellan had originally seen when he came to Guam in the 17th century. I went up to the graveyard above the village, and you can see how entire families have been decimated by this disease. Neurologists have been tantalized by it, because they felt that if they thought of the Guam disease as a sort of Rosetta Stone and felt that if it could be solved, it might provide invaluable clues for understanding ALS and Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. There have been many different theories, and one theory attributes the disease to the eating of cycads. And the cycad seeds can be ground and form a delicious flour, which can be used in soup or pancakes. It was at first thought that cycads were responsible. I regard this as a libel on a beautiful and beneficent plant. And indeed, that theory seemed to be discredited. Huxley, Darwin's good friend, used to speak of how a beautiful theory could be undermined by an ugly fact. And the cycad theory seemed to die around 1970. Then it was revived in a different form in the 1980s. And then it was revived by a colleague and myself in the 21st century, but with a special twist to it, because there were cycad eating bats on Guam, and we hypothesize that and the Chamorros are very fond of eating bats. And although the disproof seemed to be that one would need to eat a ton of cycad seeds a month to get enough of the poison, we hypothesized that the bats might concentrate the toxin 1,000-fold, and indeed they do seem to do so. The particular cycad-eating bats were hunted to extinction in the 1960s, and it's probable that there have been no new cases since then. But many people have spoken of the of our batty hypothesis, and I'm certainly not too invested in it myself. So the answers, after 60 years of medical research, we don't know what causes the Guam disease, and it's getting rarer now, and we may never know.
The other side.
Hi. I actually have a question about synesthesia, or a few little ones, actually.
Synesthesia.
Cool. First of all, is it hereditary, definitely, or so it's always destined to grow in, well, form connections that way in the brain? Are the connections always the same, like between different things like sound and color, or between, I don't know, between scales and that kind of thing? And finally, is it defined as a disease, or just like an illness, or a variation in kind of the way humans are?
Is it hereditary, and then is it defined as a disease?
In synesthesia, there's an automatic, instant, involuntary coupling of two forms of sensation, so that, for example, music may elicit a play of colors, and for people with absolute pitch, often a particular pitch will elicit a particular color. This can delight some people, annoy others, and yet others may be indifferent to it. It is strongly familiar, Nabokov had it and describes it very vividly in his autobiography. And as a child, he said to his mother that the colors, he had a box of letters, of alphabet letters, Russian letters. He said that the colors of the letters were not what they should be. His mother agreed, but would not agree with him what they should be, because two synesthetes usually don't agree. This caused almost a feud between Scriabin and Rimsky-Korsakov, both of whom were synesthetes, and both of whom sort of thought their way was the best. I don't think disease is the right term. There's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that synesthesia and the fusion of the senses may be universal in infancy, but that through pruning in the nervous system, it may disappear in the majority of people, except those genetically inclined. The same thought has also been suggested with regard to absolute pitch. Are you a synesthete? I'm sorry.
No.
No.
This side.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a synesthete, but that wasn't my question.
Speak into the microphone.
I have it in spades. I have like every single connection. But that wasn't my question. I just wanted to know if you've ever been to Costa Rica, because the plant life there, the palms and the ferns, especially if you go into the denser rainforest areas, is really like stepping back in time. So if you ever are interested in that experience again, but you don't want to take the 15-hour trip, you might want to try Costa Rica.
Recommending Costa Rica as opposed
to... Oh, okay. I misheard you. I thought you said Antananarivo. But yes, I've been to Costa Rica twice, and the last time I went to La Selva, to a botanical station, and you're right, there were, I mean, even around the station, there were hundreds of species of fern, and it was a wonderland.
Yes, Dr. Sachs, I was especially taken with your description of sitting on the beach and joining with your precious trees. It seemed to me that you were thinking like the trees think. Is that accurate?
City, island, beach.
Yes.
Thinking like the trees, is that appropriate? Yeah. Or a trick?
I'm not sure what you mean, but you're probably but you're probably right.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one more question.
In your speaking today and in other writings that I've read by you, you have what seems to me a unique way of combining the scientific and medical with the personal. I've always assumed that that's intentional, but I was wondering if you think of it that way, and if so, what's your reason for always grounding the medical in the personal?
It's never my intention, but it's always what happens. Okay. Thank you all very much. Thank you very much. I forgot to say one thing. I think we should all be very grateful to the signers. I don't know. I don't know if there's some people here from the deaf community, but even the rest of you can appreciate the beauty of this visual language.
We'd like to for you to join us outside. Again, my warm thanks to Dr. Sachs and to Aggie for a beautiful introduction, a beautiful evening. Join us outside if you brought some books to sign and some further conversation. Thank you.